and welcome to episode 10 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, Who Done It? Episode 10, my goodness. We've been doing this for 10 years. It's incredible.
And it only seems that way.
It is my great privilege and honor to introduce to you our host, director, playwright, musician, author, actor, Nick Santamaria.
So round, so firm, so fully shaped.
You know, I actually have that down here as a potential intro to you, but I know you've been on a diet, and so I didn't want to.
So I did it.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Yo, no, I am on a diet. Thanks for mentioning it. I have lost close to 30 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah. If I were in an English casino, that would be bad news. But now, I'm down to my last two belt loops, which is wonderful. And clothes are fitting better. And that's really two reasons. Clothing is going to waste because I can't wear it. And two, my health. I just wanted to be healthy, as healthy as I can be. And Jerry, you don't seem to have a weight problem.
Well, not really. I'm guessing 5-6 years ago, I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, you know, pre-diabetic type 2. And so I immediately did some dietary changes. And I knew that I'd lost weight when I was doing a show. We're out in the lobby of the theater where all of the headshots are up there, you know, with all of our pretty faces. Uh-huh. And one of my fellow actors looked at my headshot and said, "You need new headshots." "Oh, you really think so?" She says, "Yeah, there's not nearly as much of you now."
So it'd be cheaper.
But I have to say that's never really been much of an issue for me, but doing it for the health reasons, that's the main reason to do it. Yeah.
When we're frightened, we do things. I've heard from so many people around our age range saying, you know, type 2 diabetes, or I'm pre-diabetic or whatever. Yeah. And that puts the fear of God into you. And then your diet suddenly changes like magic. I did it because, number one, I was getting high blood pressure, you know, and he put me on two pills and it brought it down and everything. But I knew it was the weight. I had to take the weight off. So, you know, right away, you're threatened with a heart attack or diabetes and you think, yeah, it won't be much. It won't be hard. It won't be difficult. So I started changing the way I eat, and I don't eat bad things anymore. I look at ingredients. I look at carbohydrates. I look at fats. I look at sugars. And I look at Who Done It, which is an Abbott and Costello film that we're supposed to be talking about.
That is quite the segue, my friend. Wasn't I really impressed with that. Yeah.
There was no breath between it. It was really. But anyway, let's talk about Lou Costello's weight problem. Okay, this is the movie. This is the movie that I think most people say is their favorite if they are not, you know, fanatics like I am about Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. This is the gold standard of Abbott and Costello movies during their absolute prime. Talking about the first maybe 4 or 5 years they were making films, it was like they could do no wrong. Yeah. And this is the one that, this is the big shiny one. This is the big starring one. And this is important because Alex Gottlieb, their producer, and this is their last film produced by Alex Gottlieb at Universal. He came back to do, he was requested by the boys for Jack and the Beanstalk and Captain Kidd. So Alex made a good impression. And he came back 10 years later. You know what? It's been 10 years. Let's call Alex. Now, one of the things that Alex Gottlieb used to do, and this is very interesting, for those of you who know the comedy team Wheeler and Woolsey, they were the second most popular comedy team during the 1930s behind Laurel and Hardy. And they made a series of about 21 films. And Alex Gottlieb made up a list of their films and what they were about. And the producers and writers at Universal would look at this list and get ideas for the boys' next movies. So this one is based on Wheeler and Woolsey's The Nitwits, made in 1935, which takes place in a Brill building type building, a songwriter building. All the songwriters are there. And they run the newspaper stand in the building, in the lobby. And there's a murder. They have to find the murderer in this atmosphere. It's a professional atmosphere. And this is where they got the idea for Who Done It. Now, like most Abbott and Costello movies, it was supposed to be an earlier film. It was already prepared in 1941. But, you know, the other things got in the way, the service comedies, that were so popular. In fact, they gave this idea to a new writer at Universal. His name was Stanley Roberts. He originally started out writing Westerns, you know, odors. Then he wrote a couple of movies for the Ritz brothers at Universal. He wrote for the Andrews sisters, their starring films. And now he was on board with the boys, with the big boys at Universal, the guys who were supporting Universal. and he came aboard and wrote the original story. Originally, they were supposed to be the landscapers at the building where, you know, the radio station is, which is kind of a weird idea. They used it later on in Here Come the Coeds. They became the groundskeepers of the college. And it was also supposed to be a musical. The Andrew sisters were back, and get this, Phil Spitalny and his all-girl orchestra, his Hour of Charm orchestra, featuring Evelyn and her magic violin.
Oh, yes.
This was a very popular act on radio, and they came back eventually for Here Come the Coeds again. Mm-hmm. So they didn't throw any ideas away. Now, interestingly, about the Nitwits, it was kind of remade 2 years later with Jack Oakey as Super Sleuth, and again with the Abbott and Costello wannabes from RKO, Brown and Carney did a version called Genius at Work. Yeah, with Lionel Atwill and Bela Lugosi as their enemies. Great stuff, actually. Yeah, so it got around. So Alex Gottlieb got this going. He got Stanley Roberts working. Then he put our friend True Boardman on it with, who's the other writer? Edmund Joseph, he got on, and he had just worked on a little thing called Yankee Doodle Dandy. So they were looking up for the boys at this point. They were hiring real talent. And speaking of real talent, let's not forget John Grant, the great John Grant, who added the great routines to this already terrific script. And I love your face when I mention John Grant. I see the respect on your face.
Oh, yes.
I get the same. Oh, yes. The man was remarkable.
Yes.
He's the one that brought all the burlesque routines to the scripts. And when they were at MGM making Rio Rita, now this I just found out recently, he made friends with the director there, S. Sylvan Simon, and actually got a gig working for Red Skelton at MGM for Whistling in Brooklyn, I believe it was.
Oh.
Yeah, so John Grant was actually spreading his wings a little bit, you know, making sure he's there for Bud and Lou, but getting outside work, you might say.
Yeah, yeah.
So there were going to be songs. There were going to be musical numbers. It was going to be Hold That Ghost again, you know? not that I mind the songs, but in this one, not necessary. You did not need a song. Nobody had to open their mouths to sing in this one. Nobody had to do a boogie-woogie dance. Lou trucks at one point, you know, trucking. One of my favorite moments.
Yes.
What were you going to say, Jerry?
Well, I was just going to say, if there had been music, as much as I enjoy it, especially the Andrews sisters, this movie would not be as high up on my list as it is.
One of the things that
puts it up there for me is the fact that it's unadulterated. Mm-hmm. We get, when they show up on screen, that's it. They are there for the duration.
You put on your safety belt and you get ready for the ride.
Yeah.
And it's true, with no stops or very few stops. Even the romantic plot is not objectionable. You know, it's like two good actors doing good work, you know, following a good plot, a good strong plot in this one.
Yeah.
And what else can I want to tell you? There's some things I didn't want to forget. I made notes for. Two of them were the Wheeler and Woolsey reference. Yeah, there are some people, Patrick Knowles, I believe it's pronounced. Mm-hmm. Good actor, friend of Errol Flynn. Played in Robin Hood, played Will Scarlet wearing those horrible clothes. he looked like one of the village people. But a fine, strong actor. He had just come off The Wolfman. He was in the movie The Wolfman, which had an incredible cast, you know, for a monster movie between Claude Rains and Warren William and Ralph Bellamy and Patrick Knowles. Patrick Knowles is our leading man here. And I used to talk to him at least once a week. How did that happen? When I first got to Los Angeles, when I was 19, I got a job, a life-sustaining job, my only office job. And it was for Ames Home Loan. It was a home loan office. And I auditioned. I went in for the job. I got it. And for the less than 3 years I was there, I never understood what I was doing. I had no idea what my job was. It was very Kramer-like on Seinfeld. In fact, I was called into the office once, and he just looked at me and he went, "Do you know what you're doing?" I just said, "No." I filed a lot. But anyway, I answered phones. And one of our callers once a week was Patrick Knowles, because he made an investment. We were his mortgage company. And he was very, very nice. I had the nerve one day to say, "Pardon me, but are you so and so and so?" And he was very, very sweet, very kind. Yeah. So yeah, I especially like Patrick Knowles for that reason, other than the fact that he's a wonderful leading man. Okay, so let's begin with the film itself. I'll get to those notes as I get to them. It begins with that wonderful animated. No, it wasn't animated. It was the shadows. No, the shadows.
The silhouettes,
running.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The movie opens with my favorite logo, my favorite Universal logo. And then it shows the shadow of a man shooting another man. Two guys who are silhouetted looking like Abbott and Costello. They're obviously not.
Yeah.
They were too big at this time to do anything like that.
Yeah.
I think Pat might have been the short, fat one, though.
Highly probable.
Yeah, because he's all over this movie. Oh, and so's Norman Abbott. Remind me to tell you about that. But there's this great opening with the two of them running away from the killer, all in silhouette, and with this great Frank Skinner music. It's just fabulous. So the movie opens, and we are at a radio station. What is it, WGBS or GBS?
And, GBS, yeah.
Yeah, and George Bernard Shaw. And the, I'm sure that's what they were thinking.
Of course.
So, Bud tries to make Lou sound sophisticated so he could take him to a party and pass him off as a gentleman. Oh, wait a minute. That's Pygmalion. I'm sorry. I'm getting confused. The whole George Bernard Shaw thing. The rain in space stays mainly on the plane.
What's the matter with you?
Can't you understand? It could be a whole routine. So, okay, we are at GBS, and yes. Colonel H.R. Andrews, who happens to be an expert in code, is involved in this whole mysterious plot by the Nazis to get coded messages out through one of their radio shows. Mm-hmm. And the doctor is also in on it. Dr. Marek, his H.R. Andrews doctor, personal doctor. And that's Thomas Gomez is H.R. Andrews, one of my favorite character actors. And Ludwig Stossel as Dr. Marek. Your heart can't take it. So anyway, they're in cahoots. There's something going on with the two of them as far as this code. They're both in on it. So that day we meet producer of Murder at Midnight, and her name is Jane Little. And she's not little. She's kind of tall and lanky. Louise Albritton, who is just gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
And she is firing Jerome Cowan as writer of Murder at Midnight. And he's a little testy about it. He has to go back to writing a soap opera at this point, and he's not happy about it. But the new guy coming in is Patrick Knowles. And probably the most cringeworthy line in the entire film comes at this point. And that is when they offer him the job and he finds out that Jane Little is the producer and has offered him the job. He says, and I wrote it down here because it was just so amazing. "I'd teach for the rest of my natural born life rather than take a handout from a woman." Now, before everyone starts throwing something, this was the time. Give credit to the fact that this woman was the producer of the show, was the boss. So his asinine line really is, it's taken care of later on. He comes back kind of with his tail between his legs and apologizes. But when he gets angry and he leaves in a snit, he goes across the street to the soda fountain. And who are our two soda jerks? Bud and Lou. They're behind the counter in their soda jerk outfits. And it's one of the funniest things I think Abbott and Costello have ever done, this sequence. Right off the bat, I'm going to say that there was a review by the New York Daily Mirror that said if Lou Costello could get that many laughs out of a Limburger cheese joke, the man is a genius. And I have to tell you, it's one of my favorite Lou Costello sequences. It's absolutely hilarious. First of all, in reading about the scene, it was supposed to be this. Bud calls off camera for a Limburger cheese sandwich. There's a beat, and Lou comes in wearing a gas mask, holding the sandwich. That was it. Wow. Then Lou started improvising. And the minute he takes the cover off the cheese, he throws all the utensils up in the air. It's this enormous crash, and he just cannot open this thing without falling to pieces. The whole... And Bud is making it worse. You know, the man don't want a ham sandwich. You know, get in there with that Limburger. If you think I'm getting in there with that Limburger, you're crazy. I mean, it's one thing after another. And then, of course, he comes in with the gas mask. And even to go further, when they take the gas mask off, he's got a clothespin on his nose.
Yes.
Which you kind of see him put on. You know, as Bud is taking off the mask, you see him putting on the clothespin. But anyway, it's a wonderful sequence, and it's just the beginning of a wonderful longer sequence here in the drugstore. Mm-hmm. Now, Walter Tetley, ring a bell to you, Jerry? Walter Tetley?
Oh, yes. I'm a big fan of The Great Gildersleeve.
There you go. He's Leroy.
As well as with the Phil Harris Alice Faye show.
He's on that.
Yeah, some wonderful works.
And what about Sherman on Rocky and Bullwinkle show?
Yes.
Yeah, he was working. He was 29 years old when he made this film. He looks like he's 16. And he sounds like he's 16. He's got that voice. But this was a fellow that there are many rumors about him, that there was a birth defect, that he was, as an infant, he was accidentally castrated or something like that. He never got above like 5 foot, and his voice never changed. And it gave him a career, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't know what his private life was like, but he had a career where he worked all the time. Radio. Yeah. Oh, my God. He was everywhere. So he plays the one of the pages at the radio station, and he is constantly irritating Lou. I love the orange juice scene. He comes up to the counter and he says to Lou, Hey, Chubby, I'll bet you a nickel I could drink the orange juice faster than you can make it. So Lou takes on the challenge, and he's giving him like 17 glasses of orange juice, and he's downing them. And finally he goes, wait, you win. Here's my nickel. So he drank like 10 glasses of orange juice for a nickel. that was only the first time he gets bilked by this little page boy.
Yep.
So what happens? Patrick Knowles comes in and Mary Wicks. Now, Mary Wicks, if you are a movie fan from the old days all the way up into the 1990s, you know Mary Wicks. You've seen her on I Love Lucy. She played that very strict ballet instructor. She was hilarious. She is tall. She must be like close to 6 foot, I'd imagine. She's very tall and very thin. She has a nose that you could do yard work with. And I figure you hold her by the feet, you know, and you just swing.
Yep. There you go.
And no chin to speak of. And a little buck teeth. So there's a great joke. Bud wants Lou to make love to her, you know, to play up to her. And he goes, she's not pretty. You know, look at her mouth. And Bud says something like, so she has two buck teeth. What do I care what you paid for them? Anyway, that's one of those jokes that I thought I wrote. When I was doing Grease on Broadway, I used to get a 45-minute pre-show every night where I could just ad-lib with the audience. It was a dream come true. It was just wonderful. And one of my jokes was, when a kid would come up, I would interview all the people that came on stage. And a kid, if a tooth was missing, I'd say, oh, a tooth. Did you leave it for the tooth fairy? How much did you get? And it was always a dollar. Always. Mm. And I'd say, oh, a buck tooth. And it always got a big laugh. And I always thought I wrote it. Sure enough, when I was watching this at 6 years old, it must have taken a little place in my brain.
Yep.
And there it was. It's a cute joke, though. I like it.
Yeah.
Patrick Knowles comes in. Oh, the guy at the counter saying,
hey, how long do I have to wait? I ordered a strawberry sundae.
You did? What day is it today?
Friday.
You got 2 more days away. They
try to sell themselves as radio writers. They want to do a show. It's almost the beginning of reality television. This is reality radio. They want to solve crimes as detectives on their weekly radio show. So they're known as Muck and Meyer, and they do a part of the script, and Lou is like shooting, you know, when he has to shoot, bang, ouch, bang, ouch, bang, ouch. Wait a minute, if you're shooting the gun, why are you saying ouch? I'm holding the gun backwards. Anyway, they make it known that they want to be writers. So
yeah,
Patrick Knowles tells them that he just walked out on Murder at Midnight, that they might find a place there. And Mary Wicks also kind of connects with them at that point. So they feel that they're going to go to the radio station on the invitation of Patrick Knowles, who also has an invitation to go see Murder at Midnight as they record it live. And the boys show up at the radio station. And that's where we meet Walter Tetley again, who convinces Lou that his tickets are for yesterday and not today. So he throws them away, and Walter Tetley picks them up immediately and takes a couple of girls to the show with Lou's tickets. So Lou complains, and then they do a version of Two Tens for a Five that they did in One Night in the Tropics.
Yep.
They're already repeating. It's only 1942. But then this one is like, okay, you got two dimes for a nickel? Yeah, here you go. Same bit, only done with Walter Tetley rather than Bud Abbott. And it works beautifully. It's very
good. Yeah.
Who did it to me? And he did it to me too. Okay, so we've got them at the radio station. They sneak in to the broadcast, and they're sitting off to the side. And Colonel H.R. Andrews, our code expert, turns on his microphone, and it gets electrocuted. He dies. He's murdered. And obviously it's a Nazi spy, somebody in the studio, and that begins our big mystery. Who done it? So the boys are frightened out of their wits. They decide they're going to be the detectives. They're going to solve this case. Lou wants to leave. He doesn't want to do it. And Bud is like, we've got to do this. This will make us, you know, this will give us exactly what we want. And that's true. So I want to go back because I missed a story about Patrick Knowles. And I'm
okay.
Please bear with me because this is worth it.
Okay.
Pat Costello told the story where Patrick Knowles and he were friends. They were buddies. And he was also drinking pals with Thomas Gomez, who played H.R. Andrews, and Edmund McDonald, who's that murder at midnight, that guy. Imagine the three, Don Porter, Thomas Gomez, Patrick Knowles, all sitting at a bar drinking. But Pat Costello said that Patrick Knowles was a dramatic actor. He didn't really know comedy, especially Abbott and Costello comedy. And these guys were the biggest stars in America at this point. He was nervous. He's holding his hand during his first scene with them in the drugstore. He's holding his hand because his hands were shaking. He told Pat, he goes, I don't know how I'm going to react. I don't know what to do. They're big stars. So Pat told Lou. Lou told Bud. And the scene starts. Lou does his first line. Patrick does his first line. And Lou yells, cut! He runs to the director. He's going, what are you doing to me? You're giving me this guy with an accent and you expect me to be funny? This guy, he sounds like he's from, you know, Oxford. And I'm supposed to be funny. It relaxed everybody. Everybody laughed. Patrick Knowles was completely relaxed. And that began a nice relationship with the boys. He came back for Hit Twice, one of their better films.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of neat. Okay. So, oh boy, I have so much to say about this movie. There was a different ending shot that I want to tell you about.
Okay. We'll get there.
They cut a dream sequence. I mean, really, seriously, this is there's a lot that's not there. So, we are at Soda Jerks, Murder at Midnight, Two Dimes for a Nickel. I love that Joe Kirk is one of the suspects, and he looks very suspicious. That's Lou's brother-in-law, and he's working in the booth with the electronicals. And so everybody is a suspect. Bud convinces Lou that they're going to solve the crime. So they come back to the studio as detectives. One of my all-time favorite moments, one that I imitated many times, was when they come in and they say, okay, hold it. We're the detectives. We're going to take care of this. And they're on a lower level. There's a stage right in front of them. So Bud claps his hand and gracefully jumps onto the stage. Lou claps his hand and does a pratfall that's still can make me giggle like a 2-year-old. He is, and I did it constantly when I was part of a show called Mental Floss, and it was improv. So sometimes you had to run into the lobby while they were doing the information, so you didn't hear. So I would do that thing as I ran back to the stage. I would do the Lou Costello fall. You remember, I was the little kid in the backyard trying to fall like him, and my mother thought I was mentally challenged. So that's part of it. So also, I wanted to mention the work of Charles Van Enger, who was the photographer, the DP on this movie. It's gorgeous. The lighting in the studio, Jerry.
Yep.
The lines incredible. Across people's faces. Yeah, yeah. And do you remember the organ player, the creepy looking organ player? Norman Abbott.
Yes.
I didn't know that until last night. And I've been watching this movie since I'm, you know, in my mother's hamper. What?
But talking about the look of the film, yes, it was shot like it was a Dashiell Hammett, Sam Spade type movie.
Absolutely.
And that just adds so much to the feel and the flavor of it.
And you have to realize Earl C. Kenton. I mean, he was the director, and he had quite a list of hits behind him, and a lot of like creepy movies, horror movies too. Mm-hmm. I didn't mention last night, one of his big ones was Island of Lost Souls with Charles Laughton. Yeah, yep. That's a horror movie I can't watch now because it's too brutal. The whole thing with the animals and the vivisection and no ether, and I can't even think about it anymore. But, you know, I hate to lose it because I love Charles Laughton. Okay. They are detectives. They come back. Yeah, Lou does his detective work. Maybe we could hear a little bit of that.
Did you two get here so quickly? I just phoned the police.
Why was this murder reported yesterday?
Because it didn't happen.
Why wait till the last minute? Put it down. Make a note of that.
All right. Where's the victim?
Over there. What's he doing over there? Tell him to walk over here. We want to question him.
The man's dead.
Dead or alive. He's got to have an alibi. Come here, you. What's your name? That's a lie. Make a note of that.
It's in the book.
I'm getting a lot of silly things from this guy. He ain't answering me.
Well, grill him.
Huh?
Grill him.
I'm not hungry. Put that in the book, too. Wait a minute, you. Did you ever have the electric chair? Well, no. You're going to get it. You're going to get the electric chair and 2 years besides. You ever had the chair before?
No.
Never had it, huh? Ever have a hot foot?
Yeah.
Same thing. Different location.
The other thing I wanted to mention was Lou playing the organ with his rear end. When the murder happens and the boys have to make a quick exit, they have to pass the big organ. Lou gets stuck on the keyboard. His butt gets stuck on the keyboard. And he keeps going back and forth and playing the organ with his cheeks.
You know, I always interpreted that as the foot pedals.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Hmm. I mean, I'm sure it's part of it.
I never noticed that, you know, he's also, you know, every part of him really is playing. Because... Talking about the cinematography, the DP and his work, and the direction, there's a wonderful shot of Norman Abbott as he's at the organ playing away, and they specifically pan down to his feet, showing him playing the foot pedals as well.
The pedals. Mm-hmm.
And so when Lou went running across there, I just automatically went, oh, yeah, he's stepping on all the pedals. But, yeah, it was a full-body performance, yes.
It's a good way of putting it. my buddy Matthew Conium, who was supposed to be on this podcast, by the way, but due to some personal things, he couldn't be here. And I want to make a quick apology to my friend Brian Page, because everything happened too quickly. We'll have you on the show maybe later on. But in the meantime, yeah, Lou is actually, he's stepping on the pedals and he's playing with his cheeks, with his butt cheeks. And it's a sight to behold. Matthew talks about it in his chapter in our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello. He talks about that moment. He says, you're not going to believe it. It's truly something to behold. Okay, so they're doing the thing, and they suddenly get into this routine about watts and volts. Somebody mentions that this guy got 10,000 volts. And Lou says, well, that's enough to get anyone elected. And that starts a whole routine between Bud and Lou about what's volts. Yes, volts are what? That's what I'm asking you. What's volts? Okay, now here's the thing about this routine. First of all, the ending is perfect. Lou just says, next thing you know, you're going to be telling me what's on second, which is the first of two spotlights on who's on first. This is what I noticed about this, Jerry. They're becoming very self-aware of their fame here. And it could be the writers, it could be them, whatever it is. But now they're an institution and they're commenting on it, which I think is really neat. But what was I saying? Oh, the volts and watts. They made that up on the set. That was supposed to be 10,000 volts. That's enough to get anyone elected. Bam, finished. They started doing the watts and volts thing just on instinct. And the crew was hysterical. The crew laughed and they couldn't shoot it that way. They had to, you know, go back and shoot it again. But the boys made it up. That was all improvised.
Nice.
And it's a nice bit. It really is.
Yeah.
So, okay. They're out and about in this wonderful setting, this wonderful ultra-modern radio studio, this great building. And they have everything at their disposal. And one of the things is a water fountain. And I have to tell you, this bit got more press and more good reviews than anything else in the movie. The water fountain bit. Yeah. Another one that Lou kind of improvised as they went. It was supposed to be much shorter, but it's just Lou trying to get a drink. And every time he goes to get it, it trickles down to nothing. So he doesn't get anything. And Bud keeps urging him, go ahead, take it, go ahead, take a drink, whatever. And Lou's trying to do it, and it just keeps going away. And then finally, Bud tries, and it squirts in his face. You know, you can't really describe it. This is this is what bothered me about that Marx Brother podcast I did about Abbott and Costello. You know, I try to explain things, but it just doesn't, you have to see it. You have to see it. Let me explain this Chaplin movie to you, okay? I'm just going to go through every scene, and you know, you can't do it. Okay, so the water fountain scene is a big hit. Audiences are loving it, and at one point, Bud yells for him to come quickly, you know, whatever. And a knife goes flying into the wall right next to Lou's head. He looks at it, and he literally jumps out of his shoes, loses his hat, and runs towards Bud. Realizes that he left the stuff, his clothing behind. He goes back, he puts one shoe on, puts another shoe on his head, and the hat on his foot. Now, again, I can describe it all you want, but when you're watching it, and he's so frightened, and it's just, it really is. It's terrific.
Yes, it's one of those moments where, you know, having seen the film countless times, I still laugh at that.
Me too.
The execution, the fact that this very cartoony joke mm-hmm. of him jumping out of his shoes, literally, is so well executed in real life. And then his follow-up reaction with the hat and the shoe. And yes, it's just so good.
It's so funny. He is just, I don't know, he's on fire in this. He's just great. And then there's that moment where he finally sits down. Bud tells him, you just sit down and rest. I'm going to go, you know, take a look. And he's sitting there on it looks like an ashtray, one of those big sand ashtrays. And he's sitting there, and the coroner has been called for the dead body, of course. Lou is sitting there just kind of staring out into space, totally exhausted, totally brain dead. Milton Parsons, our driver of the bus from Hold That Ghost, is the coroner, who I always say he looks more like what should be on the slab. And he looks down at Lou and just says, yeah, this guy must have been dead for weeks. And it's Lou sitting and he sees them and he runs away. He says, oh, I'm not dead. I'm not dead. And he does a little dance to show them that he's still alive. And then he runs away. Oh, it's just, I don't know. This is Abbott and Costello Nirvana. Yeah. So Bud has an idea now. He suspects Mary Wicks. Her name is Juliet. And he tells Lou he's got to play up to her in order to find out the information. And Lou is very hesitant about it. She's a homely girl. There's no question. She was cast as a homely girl constantly. Mm-hmm. In fact, there were Mary Wicks types, you know. I think of her in White Christmas. She was the busybody. Yes. Yeah. Listening on the phone, you know. But she has an interesting scene with Lou here where it seems like they made a decision to change things between the two of them. Lou goes up to her and starts playing up to her, saying, you know, I find you attractive, blah, blah, blah. And as she turns around to leave, there's an obviously dubbed, awkwardly dubbed, well, that's great. That'll be fun. Okay, I'll see you later. And she leaves. It's something like that. It's equally innocuous. But the thing is, as she's leaving, she turns around. She clearly mouths the word wolf. You know, like a guy who picks up on girls.
Yeah.
And you can see the anger in her face. So I'm not sure what was going on there, but it wasn't what we got. I think they just wanted to cut that road, that venue or avenue, and go somewhere else. And that is proven later when they actually cut a dream sequence, which I wish they hadn't. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that when we get to it. One of my favorite bits in the whole movie, and you let me know what you think, Jerry, is when Bud and Lou walk up to one of the offices and they see the silhouette of the murderer mm-hmm. inside the office, and he's looking around and whatever. And Bud said, "You've got to go in there. You've got to go in there and get him." And Lou's like, "Why are you giving me these jobs? Why do I have to go in? Why don't you go in?" And Bud, of course, says,
"All right, we'll gamble, see who goes in."
"Okay."
"All right, take a number."
"4.
"No, number 3, you lose. Go on in. Go ahead. Go ahead."
"What?
Go on!
Let's gamble odd and even like this."
"What do you want to do, cheat?"
"No, give me a chance to ask you a number." "Well, right, you take a number."
"Number 2. Go ahead in. Go ahead."
He doesn't say anything. He just goes, nope. He just implies that he guessed it.
So Lou still has to go in.
It's a perfect example of how less is more. You know, if he had said anything.
He does that a few times in this movie where he just kind of indicates rather than there's a moment where he's being rough with William Gargan, who plays a detective. And Lou is holding onto his lapels and then just kind of looks down and feels his lapel and says, "Nice material." And then he feels his own and he doesn't say anything. He shows a face of disappointment, meaning that his suit probably cost him $2. But it's a beautiful moment. It's a beautiful moment. And I know it was ad lib. Okay. So they go into the transcription room. As they're looking around, they're in the transcription room. And Bud leaves Lou behind to go look around. You know, Bud, "I'll be over here. You do a routine. you get paid more than I do. Go ahead." Lou keeps backing up into the switch that starts the transcriptions, the recordings. So he hears the voices. So during the sequence, he keeps hitting them. So at one point, a guy says, "Don't worry, boss, I'll shoot him." And he shoots him. And Lou thinks he's really shot. And he moves over and he hits the next button. "Hey, if the bullet didn't get him, I'll stab him." And he stabs him. And Lou feels it. He knows he's been stabbed. He leans over and he hits another button. And all of a sudden you hear, "Do you have halitosis?" And Lou is like, "What do I care if I have halitosis? I've got a knife in the heart. I'm shot." Then he moves over and then he hits another button and it's an oncoming train sound. And he thinks he's on the tracks and that he's been shot and he's been stabbed and he's screaming, "Oh, I don't want to get me out of here." And Bud comes running in and finds him on his knees screaming and crying with all of this noise going on. It's just beautiful. And before they leave, Lou says, "You know, I understand the other guys, but this guy, he said something insulting." So he turns on the thing and he goes, "What was that about halitosis?" And the recording goes, "What are you going to do about it?" And that's it. They both run, you know, they both run away in fear. Lou just does not do well with outside sources, especially mechanical. Okay. And then they run into, I believe it's Colonel Andrews' office, and they want to hide because now the detectives are here. There are two real detectives that show up. One is William Gargan, who is our one of our leading men in Keep 'Em Flying. And as a kid, I don't know if you're old enough for this, Jerry. I hate to say this, but when I was a kid, William Gargan was doing commercials about cancer. He was a spokesperson for cancer because he had throat cancer in like 1960. You know, I think he lasted another 10 or 15 years, but he used to get on and warn people about smoking, which he did constantly. Yeah. But anyway, that was my first memory of William Gargan. But he's the head detective on this one, and his assistant is William Bendix, the great William Bendix. And we love him. He could do anything. You know, the same year he was doing film noir, where he was like, you know, killing people. And in this movie, he just plays a big dumb cop. "Oh, gee, boss," that kind of a cop.
Yeah.
Now, there's a story that our friend Robert Lees, one of their writers, used to tell. And none of it is true, of course. Robert Lees hated Lou Costello because he was a conservative. But anyway, he tells the story that Lou would scream, Don't you hire people like Bill Bendix. Why do we need another comedian? I'm the funny one, blah, blah. All things I couldn't possibly imagine him saying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Robert Lees wasn't there. He was writing another film at the time. He wasn't even there. But the real proof is the fact that William Bendix was Lou Costello's best friend in Hollywood.
Yeah.
They were always at each other's homes. They, you know, Bill Bendix shows up in their home movies. And Lou, who's narrating, says, and here's my best friend, Bill Bendix. So Robert Lees, you know what? Never mind. I don't want to say it. He's dead. The man is dead. And, you know, for a reason. So.
Probably because he stopped living. Yeah.
You know, and that's his doing. I have to place the blame on him. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. So Lou hides in Colonel Andrews' closet. And when Bud asks him why he's up there, he said he's looking for clues. He says, you're looking for clues? And he says, yeah, isn't this the clues closet? Okay, after the groan died down, they find Dr. Merrick has also been murdered. I'm laughing mm-hmm. because it makes me laugh. When Lou opens the closet door, he looks very briefly at Dr. Merrick, who is hanging there like by a hook with a knife in his heart. This is grisly.
Yes.
Lou opens the door, takes off his hat and says, hi, move over. I got to hide. He hangs his hat on the knife and closes the door. Then there's a beat. The door slowly opens. And there's Lou looking like he just was in close proximity with a corpse. And when he sees what it is, one of my all-time favorite gags is when he runs. And all you do is you hear him running off camera. And you see Bud's reactions. And you hear glass break. And then more glass break. And then a thud. And Bud is following him. As you know, in cartoons, when a cartoon character will run through a wall and it'll be the exact replica of his silhouette.
Yes.
That's what Lou has. These glass doorways have his perfect silhouette, complete with the space between his legs, still there, you know.
Yes.
And Bud goes through two of them and then finally finds him halfway into a wall. That was the thud. So Bud has to pull him out of the wall. And you hear the suction noise and then the pop. I'm already laughing at this point, so I can't stand it. And then they top it. Bud says, what are you doing? And Lou says, I was trying to make an impression. Oh.
Yes, totally forgetting about the fact that if you go through a sheet of glass, it is going to shatter.
Yes.
Not leave a perfect outline of your body as you go through it. And what I really love about this, yes, the payoff is great, but when Bud pulls him out of the wall mm-hmm. and you can see how deep the impression is, he was
in. He's halfway in. I just think, I don't know, being a writer, I can't picture myself coming up with something like that. It's just so unbelievably funny and clever.
And again, it's another example of cartoon humor.
Yes.
You know, you mm-hmm. watch The Roadrunner and you see this all over the place.
Can I tell you something? You just said that as I was looking at a note I took. I said, Lou is exactly like Bugs Bunny.
There you go.
Talk about a coincidence. Better finish your thought though, because we're obviously on the same page.
Well, yeah, but this far into their career, they're huge hits and they've had fantastic movies and they're popular and they're making money for Universal. Somebody had to consciously say, let's try something a little different.
Yes.
Because mm-hmm. they've never gone to this extreme up to this point.
Right.
With the cartoonish type of humor. I think that's, for me anyway, that's why it works.
Yes.
Because it is fresh. It's something we've never seen from them before. And it is so well executed.
Oh, yeah, especially well executed. And we haven't even gotten to the finale yet, which I just.
Oh, yeah.
It's so clever. So what I was going to say about Bugs Bunny is that he becomes something else at a moment's notice. At one point, Bill Gargan and Bill Bendix are chasing after them, and he runs into an elevator. He grabs the elevator operator's hat, puts it on, and he's the elevator operator. Oh, sorry, yes. Pull up, take the next one, you know. Yeah. It's Bugs Bunny.
Yeah, sorry, Doc, pull up, sorry, next car.
Right?
Yep.
But I wanted to get into this elevator. And that's what it is. And that's why, yes, Bugs Bunny shows up on their radio show.
Yes.
The Abbott and Costello show. They actually have Bugs Bunny as a character on a few of the episodes. Mel Blanc. They loved him. As who doesn't? So, yeah, this year was big. Talking about Warner Brothers, this was also the year that they were Warner Brothers cartoon characters. A Tale of Two Kitties. They are Babbitt and Catstello.
Yes.
And they are after a very, very early version. It might even be the first of Tweety Pie. Yeah, Tweety Pie. He refers to him as a naked genius at one point because Tweety Pie has no feathers at this point. Yeah. He's a baby, and he's the deadliest baby you would ever imagine. Somehow in his nest, he has sticks of dynamite that are twice his size and, you know, bombs, you know, with the fuses. But anyway, it's a very funny cartoon, and it really does hit on the humor of Abbott and Costello. So let's get to the guys chasing, the real detectives chasing Bud and Lou. They have a feeling that Bud and Lou are responsible for all of this because they have been illegally imitating policemen. So they want to catch them. They're dead set on catching them. Bud and Lou end up backstage at a theater. And this is not unlike where they were in Pardon My Sarong with Bill Demarest. They seem to do a lot of things with people named Bill. So there is an act about to go on stage called, are you ready? The Flying Bordellos. How they got away with that, I have no idea. Apparently, this movie was one of the least commented upon by the Breen Society, by the censors. And really? How, I guess they just sort of set it aside. They sort of missed it, you know? But the Flying Bordellos, they even say it. Next up, the Flying Bordellos. I mean, okay, fine. I don't know how they got away with it, but I love it. So the guys have to hide. Bud goes off on his own, and Lou dresses up like one of the Flying Bordellos, and he becomes very Bugs Bunny-like. He becomes an acrobat, which he clearly isn't. This is also one of my favorite sequences. Lou is so confident about his skills, even though he has fallen through a hole in the stage. He has caused the six members to all fall in on themselves. He's making a disaster of this, and he just keeps taking bows for it. He's just so proud of himself. It's really a funny bit. And it's Laurel and Hardy-like in the sense that you see the gags coming, but it doesn't matter. You know, you just can't wait to get there, you know? And that's what kind of sequence this is. And we mentioned trucking before. Well, when the boys are trying to get away after this, Bud, after they put their heads through those cutouts, the scenery, yes, to hide, and Bud is an angel. He has an angel's body, and he's doing this thing with his eyes. He's fluttering his eyelids, so he looks like an angel. And then you cut to Lou, and he's a cherub. He's a naked cherub. You only see his butt. And he gives it the whistle. I can't do the whistle, though. So they get out. Bud runs into the back of a truck and tells Lou to come on over here. And Lou can't find him. He's saying, where are you? And Bud says, truck. And Lou starts trucking. Now, trucking is that dance that you see in a lot of old movies and cartoons where they hold their forefinger up by their heads, basically, or up just away from their heads. And they shake their fingers while they do this rhythmic dance back and forth on their feet. And that's called trucking. There's even a great song called Trucking that was in the big broadcast of 1938 with W.C. Fields. Martha Ray does it, and it's called Everybody's Trucking. Anyway, I love to see Lou do it. It's a funny, cheap joke, and it always makes me laugh. So they're in the back of the truck, and the man driving the truck happens to have his radio on, and there is a show called Wheel of Fortune. And now there's no Vanna. Yeah, Wheel of Fortune. There's no Vanna. There's no Pat. And it's basically, if we call you, you have 5 minutes to respond if you're not there, and you win $10,000 as soon as we connect with you. And the name of the winner happens to be Mervyn Q. Milgram, who happens to be Lou Costello.
Yep.
Now, first of all, Mervyn Milgram, is his name in this movie. And I have to say, whenever I have to think of a name quickly, and it's not Debbie Reynolds, it's Mervyn Milgram. And I already decided that my next pet is going to be Mervyn. All right. So anyway, they hear about that. They hear of it. Can you imagine? Mervyn! So the boys hear about this. They get out of the truck, and there happens to be a drugstore on the corner, and they can get to a phone. And what's the phone number, Jerry?
Alexander 2222.
Okay. So they run into the drugstore. Lou picks up the phone and just says, Alexander 2222. And Bud's, no, no, you have to drop a nickel. And of course, Lou drops a nickel on the floor and then says, give me Alexander 22. Anyway, he drops a nickel. Bud gets out of the scene again and says, I'm going to go figure out how to spend your money. He goes to the soda counter and gets a soda. So Lou does my favorite. This may be my very favorite, is him trying to get in touch with Alexander 2222. Now, they've done it a few times. They did it on the live show beautifully, by the way. It's in their first Colgate Comedy Hour. In this sketch, he does a thing where he walks into the side of the phone booth and hits his head. And it comes at a point where you can't help but laugh. You know, it's like, and he does it really well in this Colgate Comedy Hour. You see him working live and the audience just loses it. They go nuts. And it works just as well in this film. And I want to tell you, the other times they do it are not as good because there's no urgency. He just has to make a phone call. He's calling Joe Bazzo, you know, in the thing, or in the television show. He's trying to get in touch with somebody. I forget what it is. But in this, he's got 5 minutes. Or he loses the $10,000. Now, $10,000 in those days was, you know, you could buy 3 houses, you know, one on top of another. But anyway, there are moments in this sketch that just make me weak with laughter. And the main one, see, the contrivance of this thing is that he is desperate to make this phone call, which is right across the street. The studio is right across the street. He has to suffer people calling places like Brazil and getting immediately connected, Moscow getting immediately connected, the Klondike, whatever. And then he gets up and, I'm sorry, the line is busy. So that's what it is. It's the frustration. Well, this woman comes in, she calls Moscow, and you'll hear it.
Operator, I want you to get me Moscow, Russia. Thank you. The conservative music, Tinkovsky's, yes. Oh, Professor Tinkovsky, how do you do? This is your American pupil, Mrs. Leffingwell. You know, I've learned that new aria. You want to hear? Thank you. Now to me, oh, me, oh, me. You do? Oh, thank you so much. Oh, goodbye, goodbye.
Over here on the other
side of the street. The line is busy. Wait, have a place, get for me.
I'm over $10,000. Number, please.
Alexander 2222.
I can't hear you.
Alexander 2222.
Louder, please.
If I talk any louder, I will have to call them up. They'll hear me.
I'm sorry, sir, but you are all wet.
Okay. That noise you heard was him walking directly into the side of the phone booth and hitting his head, and it is just hilarious. And then when he picks up the phone and starts singing again, I just lose it. I lose it. He just absentmindedly starts singing again to the operator. He's so wrapped up in what he's doing. So finally, at the end, the operator tells him, you're all wet. And he's, I'm all wet. I'm all wet. And he grabs a seltzer bottle, shoots it into the phone, and it shoots out onto the woman's face, which I'm sure it got a big hand from all the people who had to deal with phone operators, you know, which don't exist anymore, really.
No,
right? No. They've gone the way of the busy signal.
And I wonder what Alexander Graham Bell would have thought about the seltzer water going through the phone line into the woman's face.
I don't know, but I have a feeling he would have conferred with Don Ameche about it.
More than likely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so that sketch is actually a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it's actually standalone. You could watch just that sketch. And I think they have it on YouTube, just as is, you know. But it's wonderful. So they do that thing, and they go to the studio to collect their $10,000. But Jerry, there's one thing I had to mention. I just looked over, and there is something from Kevin Brownlow. And I'm so sorry about that. I know you have trouble with these little side trips, journeys, but I can't, he's so kind to us. He loves our, he listens to our show religiously, honestly. In fact, he called me from a church as he was watching. And, told me about this clip he has. Now, this is very rare in the sense that this was recorded before tape existed. This was done on an Edison cylinder. And this is October 1897, the birth of William Alexander Abbott. Hold on, I'm going to try and hook this up. This is not easy. And the sound may be a little off. There it is. Hold on. Listen.
All right, Miss Abbott. Mrs. Abbott. All right, push. Keep pushing. You have to... there it is. I see it. All right. This is so strange. This baby's wearing a fedora. Hey, what? This... hold on. I'll try and slap it.
What are you doing slapping me like that? What are you, crazy or something?
I'm your doctor. I'm pulling you out of your mother.
Don't get dirty with me. What are you, crazy? Talk sense. What are you...
Stop hitting me. You dropped your fedora.
And that's all there is. It's... I mean, really, you talk about rare recordings. And, you know, I feel so privileged to share it. Thank you, Kevin, for that one. Glad you're enjoying the show. So there you go. And I don't know if he kept the fedora, if it was covered with placenta. I really don't know, but it was quite a find. And speaking of finds, let's not forget to mention that they recently found Bud Abbott's birth certificate for the first time. My friend, was it Jeff Salamander? I believe it was him. He found the actual birth certificate, and it said he was born on October 6th rather than October 2nd. Also that he was born in 1897 in Asbury Park, New Jersey. It was not in Pennsylvania, just over the border. So I just wanted to share that. That's new information, new Abbott and Costello information.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty cool. So let's get to this. Handcuffs. Yes. Bill Bendix and Lou are left in the office, and Bill Bendix is telling him about handcuffs, what they can do. He can go, I can cuff you and take you out of here. And Lou's like, no, I'd wait till you bent over and I'd hit you with them because that's iron and that hurts. And he goes, no, I'd put it behind your back. And he goes, no, show me. I don't know what you mean. So he actually locks Bill Bendix's arms behind his back in the handcuffs. And it starts a routine that they've done three or four times on both television shows, in another movie. They do it in Captain Kidd with Charles Laughton.
Yeah.
But in this one, it's Bill Bendix, and Lou really takes advantage of the fact that his hands are bound, and he's slapping him in the face. He's yelling at him. He's kicking him in the butt. And then he goes to get Bud. And while he's out to get Bud, Mary Wicks comes back and unlocks him, takes the key and unlocks him with the promise that he won't arrest, you know, the boys. So he does it. He agrees to it. But then he's waiting for Lou to come back. He pretends to have his hands locked behind his back. And it becomes a whole routine where, you know, Lou's showing off for Bud that he could hit him and get away with it. And every time he turns his back, you know, Bill Bendix will scratch his head, you know, and show that he's not. And Lou will just catch the end of it and, you know, give us the eye. You know, it's a very, very good routine. Yeah. And I have to tell you that yesterday I was hopping around YouTube like I want to do, and I found a half-hour television show from 1950, The Pinky Lee Show. Pinky Lee. Now, this was not a children's show. This was for the adults. It was burlesque people, burlesque routines. The guest was famous Hollywood heavy Anthony Caruso, who I love. Mm-hmm. And they do handcuffs. And it's pretty much, it's the same routine. It's an old burlesque routine. Yeah. And it's a lot of fun. And Pinky Lee, I just think he's, because he was a children's personality for so long, he got pegged as that. But if you look at him in a movie called Lady of Burlesque with Barbara Stanwyck, he does his stuff and he is just incredible. Not only was he a very funny comedian, but he could tap dance like nobody's business. Just terrific. In fact, in storage, I have a actual Pinky Lee taps, metal taps, unopened in the package, the original package. Anyway, there's one thing he does that Lou does. And this is worth talking about, Jerry. He's got Bill Bendix locked up.
Yeah.
You know, his hands behind him. He starts doing Shemp boxing stuff. You know the Shemp's boxing shtick? It's the same shtick.
Yes.
And I've seen Larry Fine do it as well. So I guess I'm not sure if Shemp made it up or if it was just a thing that people did. I have a feeling Shemp made it up because he does it so well.
He does. But here's a classic example of Lou taking something like that and making it his own. He goes into that routine and then on the last swing does a gorgeous pratfall right in front of Bendix.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. He does. He gives a great ending. So anyway, the guys use the fact that Lou humiliated one of the cops to get them to play along with them and just say, come on, guys, you know, we're all here to do the same thing. So Patrick Knowles and Louise Albritton are two lovers. They decide that they're going to reenact the night of the murder at the radio studio on Murder at Midnight, and they will expose the killer. Now, they're taking a chance here. I always thought this was a little iffy. It's like, you know, they were counting on something to happen that did happen, but it could have not happened. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
If Lou had not plugged in the radio. Right. And when I say the radio, when they win the $10,000, they show up at the studio. The orchestra is happily playing, "You're a hockey fella, Mr. Smith." So they go up and they hand Lou the $10,000 check once he shows his ID from the Girl Scouts of America or the Campfire Girls.
Campfire Girls. Troop and 34.
It's good. Troop 34. That's right. That's good enough. Good enough. So he hands him the check and then he gives him as another bonus, he gives him a radio, a portable radio. And Bud says, now, come on, we're partners. We split everything 50-50. Obviously, Bud didn't get the memo, but we split everything 50-50. And Lou measures the weight of the radio against the weight of the check and hands Bud the check and says, here, you take the check. I'll keep the radio. He turns it on, and what's playing?
What's the fella's name on third base?
But what's on second?
Who's on second?
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go.
Back. Oh, no.
Every time you hear those two guys, who's on first? What's on second? I don't know. That little fat guy, he killed. No good.
Come
no
on,
good.
Let's go.
Another meta moment.
Really
showcasing their superstardom at this point. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just wanted to go back and mention that gag. But they are arrested there, and that takes them back to the studio. So they're going to reenact the whole thing on the radio on Murder at Midnight. Lou decides that he wants to listen to it on the radio while he's actually in the studio, which is a wonderful childlike thing to do. You know? I'm going to take another side note here. I'm sorry, gang. Please forgive me. But I am addicted to something on YouTube that I don't know how to explain it, but it's addicting. There are these twin Chinese babies that you follow from really their first weeks all the way up to they're now about 2 years old. And they are so funny because they are Abbott and Costello, basically, or the Three Stooges, or Laurel and Hardy, but for real. They do nothing but fight. One will walk up behind the other one and hit him on the head with a cup and then walk away laughing while the other one turns around, grabs a cup, runs to the other one, hits him on the head. It's just, it's relentless. And I just can't get enough of it. You know, this is like real comedy. It's real life.
Yeah. But
as I was watching Lou last night, I'm thinking, I don't think any other performer has captured what childlike behavior truly is. Mm-hmm. Some people try to imitate it. Some people, you know, give you a half-assed impression of it or slip in and out of it. Lou, he is those babies. It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. It was quite something last night. I was like, this is familiar because I've been watching these babies. Okay, so they are doing the reenactment. Lou decides he has to plug in the radio, which happens to be right near the murderer. Should we tell them who the murderer is? I don't know. Maybe.
Spoiler alert. Okay, yeah.
Spoiler alert. If you don't want this, you know, go ahead. It's Don Porter. Don Porter, terrific actor, loved making this movie, loved Bud and Lou, talked about the set and how they ad-libbed and the cameraman would ruin takes by laughing. He is the killer. And there is a rooftop chase. First, they get in an elevator that is completely out of control. It's just bouncing up and down in top speed. And you see the boys inside rolling around on the floor and whatever. And when it stops, Lou does a pratfall, a trip and a pratfall. Mm-hmm. That is, it's gorgeous. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah.
And it makes me laugh every time. And of course, Lou wants to go back. Why do you want to go back? Kept my stomach. So they end up on the roof because Lou says killers always hide in the cellar. So they go to the roof. And of course, the killer is there on the roof. They have to confront them. Lou runs away. Bud decides there's a box of light bulbs and he starts throwing them on the floor. So it sounds like gunshots and it works. Only at one point, the guy sees him and shoots and the bulb explodes in Bud's hand and he runs away. Well, Don Porter said that the expert who was supposed to shoot missed him like three times. And he was the champion of this group he was part of when he was younger. And he was a marksman. So the bulb exploding in Bud's hand was actually shot by Don Porter, the killer. Ah. So he shot in one shot and in his close-up, and then he shot again for Bud's close-up. Oh, so man. Anyway, that's one of the things that you're going to learn listening to this podcast. So the cleverest thing about the rooftop, discounting the flagpole and walking on the wires and all that stuff, is there is a big illuminated sign on top of the roof that says, vote for Townsend Phelps.
Yeah.
Lou looks at it, gets an idea. Now, this is the genius of an idiot, right? You know, the when you're so smart, you're stupid. Lou sees something in that, and he takes his rubber glove, which was the one clue they had. Reminds me of OJ, by the way. And he keeps picking up rocks, and he would use the glove as a slingshot, and he would take out certain bulbs. And eventually, Townsend Phelps became Send Help. Clever. Really clever.
Very.
Unfortunately, Don Porter is standing right behind them. and Lou climbs up. And there's the electrical stuff up there. There's wires and you know, conductors and musicians, everything. Yeah. So Lou has to walk across the wires, of course, and Bud is on the other side egging him on. Do you remember when you used to walk the cracks in the sidewalk? And Lou has to get up and walk. And in the meantime, Bobby Barber is in the control room, completely innocent, has no idea what's going on. But when Lou finally gets electrocuted, when the electricity starts, it's also happening to Bobby Barber in the booth. And it's so funny. It's so funny. And then he finally turns it off and it turns it off for Lou. Eventually, Lou falls off and lands on Don Porter and captures him. Cool. So Lou is the hero and Bud gets mad. What about me with those bulbs? I did something over there. I deserve my 40%. So anyway, Bud and Lou are the heroes. And the detective says to Lou, Bill Gargan says to Lou, listen, if there's anything I can do for you, just let me know. He says, really? Could you make me a junior G-man? Well, if you promise to eat your spinach, it's that kind of a moment. But I noticed that was the same year that the Dead End Kids did a serial for Universal called Junior G-Men. Ah. I really, for the first time, I thought to myself, Lou's plugging a Universal product.
So, there you go.
Right at the end. The other thing I noticed about this, as they're all standing around at the end, the very ending is Lou says that he wasn't affected by all the electricity that went through him. And Bud hands him a bulb, and the bulb lights up, of course. And then Bud grabs it from him. He shakes his hand and it lights up in Bud's hand. So Lou grabs it and he throws it at the sign that says send help. And the lights go out. The only things that are illuminated is the word end instead of send. And that's the end. It fades out there. The original ending, which was shot. Oh, did you have something to say, Jerry?
Well, I was just going to mention two things. First of all, I was extremely impressed in this film that Bud was so brave.
Yes.
There are so many moments in this where he is actually leading. We got to go chase this guy. We got to catch this guy. The whole light bulb thing was you know, a bit of bravery on his part. Now I come to find out he actually was holding a bulb and it got shot out of his hand. That is courage, with a BB gun.
Don Porter missed. Don Porter missed twice before he hit it. Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you is: this the first appearance of Bobby Barber with Bud and Lou? I think it is
the one that survived. He was in Hold That Ghost, but he was cut.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. As another waiter. Right.
Yeah. There's a still of Lou writing on his head, on his bald head. But yeah, no, this is his first on camera, his first that he made it into the film itself. Okay. So the original ending was shot and they eschewed it. They went for the this other ending, which I kind of like better, to be honest with you. This one was they all meet on the rooftop after the killer is caught. And somebody mentions, I think Patrick Knowles mentions, that something was going on in a refrigerated room in the studio itself. It was something, I don't know what it was, that why it was refrigerated, but it was refrigerated for some reason. And Lou is, you know, interested and he backs up and he actually falls down one of those shafts, you know, that you see, it looks like something you see on a ship, you know?
Yes.
And he falls down it and you hear the crash and everybody runs downstairs and there's Lou encased in a block of ice. And that's the end. That would be the end. To me, it's kind of cold, you know? It's not as clever. I'm sorry about that. It's not as clever as what they actually had. Now, I want to discuss two things. Number one, not really discuss, but mention. Louise Allbritton does not look amused at all. Every time I see her in a scene, I picture her making a beeline to the phone, calling her agent and saying, "Get me off this film!" She just seemed like one of those ladies that, you know, she wanted something more serious, you know, something more. But thank God for Pat Knowles, who actually enjoyed every moment of it. And the person who spoke most highly was Don Porter. He just had the time of his life. No pun intended. He had a wonderful, wonderful time, even playing the killer. You know, it was just fun to watch them work. And that was his thing. A lot of people said that they were very uncomfortable working with them because they honestly ad-libbed most everything. But he actually enjoyed it. He actually enjoyed watching the process. The other thing was this movie is important for a couple of reasons. One you mentioned earlier was no music, no supporting, you know, oomph behind it. But the other thing is their relationship grows. Their relationship becomes more realistic. It becomes more supportive. It becomes less about Bud trying to, you know, bilk Lou out of his money or whatever. They are a team. They are buddies. They are working together for a shared goal. And I really like that in this movie because it kind of becomes that way now. That's what they are now. Yeah. And it took them a little while to get there, but they got there. So anyway, that's one of the things I love most about this movie.
You had mentioned a dream sequence that had been cut.
Okay. There was a big fracas in the transcription room with the two Bills and Bud and Lou, and everybody's fighting. Juliet comes in, grabs a stack of records, and is going to break it over the detective's head, but she does it over Lou's head instead. This graphic comes on showing that he's out cold, and we were supposed to go to a Romeo and Juliet scene. This is the dream sequence where Lou is Romeo. He's in tights and everything else. He's got a sword that's way too big for him. And Juliet is up on the balcony and he puts a ladder up and he starts climbing But the ladder starts sinking into the ground. Every time he steps on a rung, it'll go lower and lower. Anyway, at the end, they do a bunch of ladder gags that they later use in It Ain't Hay, which is the next movie coming up. So they did not throw any of that away. They just made it a different scene, basically. And then Bud comes in at the end, dressed in tights and the whole bit, and challenges Lou to a duel. And something happens where Lou gets hit on the head, and then he comes back into the scene. That's where Bill Gargan is like slapping him on the face, and he comes back into consciousness. But it's a little awkward, you know, because you can tell he's knocked out. They do this weird graphic, and then they cut to Bill waking him up very quickly. There's nothing in between. It's like we blacked out with Lou, you know.
Well, yeah, even before I knew that this scene had been planned, it's just an odd moment as you're watching the film. As you say, you feel like there should be something here.
Yes. And sure enough, there was. So go figure. To anyone listening out there, I know most people are Abbott and Costello fans if you're listening to this. But if you're not and you're being introduced to them, I couldn't recommend a better film. This is the film that you should watch first, as far as I'm concerned. It's near perfect. It's a near perfect film. Like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, it is a near perfect film. And again, the only reason I prefer Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is because I'm such a stubborn monster kid. I love the monster. And Bud and Lou are just fabulous in it. And the writing, the greatest. So this one, just a hair beneath. And I mean a hair. So what do you got to say about it, Jer?
I agree with you wholeheartedly, just in the opposite direction. I put this one just a hair above Frankenstein.
Why?
Why?
It's my favorite letter. Yeah.
You?
That's another one.
Yeah. No, I think it's because it is just them, really.
Yes.
And they carry it, they keep it moving. Everything is hinged upon them, and what plot there is handled quickly and with minimal fuss, just to get back to them.
That's true. That's absolutely true, and I agree with you in that sense. That's why this movie is so great. Of all the Abbott and Costello movies that don't feature monsters, this is my favorite. How's that?
Okay.
Folks, really, take my word for it. If you haven't seen this film, or if you haven't seen it in a long time, take the time. It's less than 90 minutes, and I guarantee you will laugh. I promise you. And during these days, Jerry, where you go to the supermarket and you have to take out a loan, you know, to buy a carton of eggs, I think this is something that'll cheer you right up, honestly, and it'll make you really go out and buy some eggs. So I think we've reached the end of another podcast, Jerry. How are you feeling about the response we're getting?
Wonderful. The comments that I have seen have all been positive and favorable. I've got a couple of very good friends who I have pointed in this direction, and they are just head over heels enjoying it.
Oh, great.
Even, dare I say it, all the Bud Abbott stuff that is being unearthed. But
you
still
can't blame me for that. It's Kevin Brownlow. He's 90 years old. He's got nothing to do. You know what I mean? He sits around listening to our podcast all day long. Sometimes he'll listen to one three times in a row. He's very lonely. So, you know, I want to thank you, Kevin, honestly. So here we are. And there was something you mentioned just before this. Yes, the response. I did get one negative response. Yeah, some troglodyte wrote a comment. I'd since erased it. But he said, during one of our podcasts, I made a comment about Laurel and Hardy. I was comparing the violence level and that Laurel and Hardy were just as, if not more violent than Abbott and Costello. And I said something like, take that, Laurel and Hardy fans, or eat that, Laurel and Hardy fans. I said. And he took umbrage. He said, oh, that's a great way to start a following by saying something like that. And I just wrote back and I said, goodbye. And that was it. He didn't get it. He just didn't get it. I love Laurel and Hardy. I love them. They are my second favorite comedy team. And I, again, it's like Whodunit and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. It's only by a hair, you know?
Yeah.
Abbott and Costello just resonate more with me because I, maybe because I'm a New Yorker. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I love Laurel and Hardy, but I also see the cracks. Laurel and Hardy fans tend to be, how can I put it? They're very worshipful. Mm-hmm. And they're Laurel and Hardy can do no wrong. Laurel and Hardy, their characters loved each other. They were brothers. They were this and that. Anyway, Laurel and Hardy hit each other as much as the Three Stooges. Oliver Hardy steps on a 3-inch rusty nail in the music box. I can go yes. on and on and on. So, you know, let's not be children about this. Let's just accept what it is mm-hmm. and realize that I'm usually correct. All right. So, no, if that gentleman is listening, I hope you didn't take umbrage at the troglodyte comparison, because I tried to do worse. So we're moving on to another special film in their canon. And this one is special for basically the main reason is that they're doing an adaptation of a Damon Runyon story.
Yes.
And it's a Damon Runyon story that Universal filmed about 7 years before. Without Abbott and Costello. So we're going to be learning about this story. And I have some interesting things to say about this one. And the outtakes from this movie tell a very interesting story. And we'll get to that in our next podcast when we look at It Ain't Hay. Jerry, thank you so much. As usual, this was the highlight of my week. I love talking Abbott and Costello with you.
Nick, same back at you. Thanks, I look forward to these times.
Me too. Me too. This is a lot of fun. And I hope people out there are having fun as well. Yeah. Get our book. I noticed that the Abbott and Costello Forever Facebook page has 8,900 people. 8,900. Now, if all of those 8,900 bought our book, I could live in the south of France in a villa. So... It has been called essential. It has been called, if you love Abbott and Costello, get the book. And also the podcast is now being recorded, what, twice a month? And yes. We still have 28 movies to go. So here we go. We are intrepid if we are anything. All right, Jerry, you take care and have a wonderful, wonderful 2 weeks before we gather together once more.
And you as well, my friend. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye, everybody.